Thank you very much. Are these microphones working? Does this one work? Well, can you hear me if I don't use them? I guess I'm not talking close enough to speak right into it. Okay, thank you very much. I'll give it another try in the stand. Really, the conversation we were talking about a moment ago, the introduction, is probably the most vital, important problem that our nation has ever had to endure. I think this problem is more important than the Civil War as far as causing irreparable harm to our society. We came out of the Civil War and flourished and succeeded and progressed despite that catastrophic situation. But the question is, and I hate to use this cliche since you've all heard it, the decline of a civilization, whether or not we can survive the current problem with sex education, which I feel is at the top of the pinnacle, and pornography and homosexuality and the American psychiatrics pronunciamento that perversity is normal. Incidentally, I really am interested in psychoanalysis, not psychiatry per se. The psychoanalysis and psychiatry are two different things. But whether we can survive this holocaust, and truly, I know these terms have been used over and over again, but whether we can survive it, I'm sure we can, but it's not going to be easy, and it's going to take a lot of work, especially from people such as yourselves, because there isn't anybody else apparently terribly interested in this or enough to come out and attend a meeting concerning it. But before discussing, and may I say that my title of my talk should be A Psychoanalytic Look at Sex Education. A Psychoanalytic Look at Sex Education. However, Sex Education Boomerang probably sounds less controversial. So either title, but this will be a psychoanalytic look at sex education. But before discussing why and how today's public school sex education's cause irreparable harm to students and the society, I would like to take a moment of your time to mention three basic psychoanalytic facts concerning human sexuality. Now, you already know these facts. I'm just going to repeat them for you, so bring them to your attention for the purpose of this presentation. But the first fact, which is a psychoanalytic precept that's been established, but which the human being has known for 5,000 or more years since the beginning of man, the first fact is that in humans, sex is an intimate affair. Two people in love seek total privacy during their sexual relationships. Intrusions of others into their physical sex life normally arouse intense feelings of shame and jealousy. And the more two people are in love, the more they suffice for each other. It is only when love is lacking that people are able to share physical sex with others or in groups. When this takes place, a regression of the mind occurs to a primitive state in which love plays no part in the sex act, as it did at one time in the earlier development or some pagan periods of our existence. So to repeat this first fact, again, which you already know, intimate monogamous love is an inborn characteristic of human sexuality. Its need to be limited to two people only is prescribed by the very nature of the sex act itself. Sex act itself does not entertain the possibility of more two people except in some sorts of perversions, and that is not normal sex. Today's public school sex courses disregard this first indelible fact concerning human sexuality. The second fact that I like to bring to your mind again is that in humans, the sexual instinct is composed of two parts, an affectionate part and a physical part. The affectionate component is as important, if not more so, than the physical component in both men and women. For human sexuality to be complete, for it to be a normal human sexuality leading to a monogamous relationship, there must be a confluence, a coming together of the affectionate and physical parts of the sexual instinct. And this is what we're seeing today. When affectionate needs are weakened and physical sex is all that remains for these people, sex becomes meaningless and life becomes terribly empty. Throughout public school sex classrooms, physical aspects of sex are emphasized while affectionate needs are damned by the faintest of praise. And the last basic psychoanalytic fact that I'd like to mention, and the one that I will try to use in order to show why sex education is so devastating to the society and to the student, the third basic psychoanalytic fact is that in humans, unlike any other creature on Earth, three phases of sexual development occur before adult sexual maturity is reached. There are three phases of development in the human sexual growth before adult mature sexuality is reached. Briefly, the first phase begins at birth and lasts through the fifth year of life. The second phase of human sexual development occurs between the ages of 6 to 12. And the third phase starts around 13 and lasts until early adulthood. Today's public school programs, which incidentally, as you probably know, Planned Parenthood and sex educators now euphemistically refer to in such ways as family life programs, family life studies, etc., ad infinitum. But today's school sex programs, whatever you call them, all completely shatter all three phases of normal human sexual development. Now, to understand how public school sex education destroys normal human sexual development, let's briefly, bear with me, and let us briefly look at the three phases of sexual development. I'll make them very brief. And at the same time, also look at the sex instructions given to students during each of these three phases. So our effort to show the damage done by sex education in any phase, under any name, we'll do it by looking at the stages of development and see what's taught these kids and what effect it has upon them. The first phase of human sexual development, as previously noted, begins at birth and lasts through the fifth year of life. Incidentally, this first phase is divided into three stages. During the first phase, the initial sensual pleasure of life is derived from the sucking that is associated with the infant's need for nourishment. And so you can see from the very beginning, normal sensual pleasure is essential for sustaining life. The sucking or oral stage passes into a rather interesting stage, which we refer to as the aggressive anal stage in the second year of life. Now, sensual aggressiveness consists of the desire to master another by force rather than by wooing. And I know it may seem strange, and I'm not going into the explanation of this stage, but it may seem strange to you folks that the predominant sensual urge in a small two-year-old child is derived from aggressiveness, but such pleasure may not seem so surprising if one realizes that cruelty is a primitive vestige that remains a part of the sexual instinct throughout life. The aggressive stage passes into the childhood third sexual stage at about the age of 3 and continues through the fifth year of life. Excuse me. The 3 to 5 year old primary sensual pleasure, unlike the other two ages, 1 to 2, but the 3 to 5 year old child's primary sensual pleasure is derived from the desire to see and show nudity. It can be readily seen, for example, just to give you an example of it, in the innocent but unmistakable sensual excitement that some 3 to 5 year old children exhibit when gleefully running around the room nude after a bath, and I'm sure some of you parents have seen that with my five children I have. Normally, these early childhood stages of sexual growth, these are all, now we're not talking about adult sexuality, we're not talking about copulation, we're talking about sensual feelings that lead to mature adult sexuality. And so normally these early childhood stages of sexual growth consisting of all aggressive and exhibitionistic voyeuristic impulses are passed through very smoothly and usually give only fleeting glimpses of their development. The important thing, the most important thing in life as far as sexual development is concerned, is children must not be made to linger in these early stages of sexual growth that comprise the first phase of human sexual development. If sex educators or child molesters cause the child to linger in these oral, aggressive, voyeuristic, exhibitionistic stages of infantile sexuality, or perhaps sensuality would be a better word, an arrest, that is a fixation in these early stages may occur, and further forward sexual growth may cease. What a disaster if that happens. Nevertheless, this is exactly what may result from Planned Parenthood-type sex education given to kindergarten students. Well, let's just look. What does kindergarten sex teach these 3 to 5 year old students? Kindergarten sex instructions consist of repeatedly demonstrating nudity, male and female genital anatomy, and of showing how humans, as well as some animals, mate. The first animal I think they used was chickens. I learned that back in 67, when somebody talked to me about Mary Calderon, she was giving a talk at one of the local colleges. I had just finished giving a talk to 2 classes on human sexuality. And some professor asked me, did you know that this lady's going around the country teaching children how chickens mate in order to teach them sex? Well, that seems very odd to me, and it still does. But nevertheless, this is what kindergarten sex instruction consists of: demonstrating of nudity, demonstrating a male and female genital anatomy, and showing how humans, as well as some animals, mate. The problem is that the 3 to 5 year old child has absolutely no need for these or any other such sex interferences. The instructions have no beneficial effect and can only serve to disrupt the child's further forward sexual growth by causing a fixation in exhibitionistic, voyeuristic activities. Let's give some other examples. For example, talk about repeated demonstrations of nudity given in kindergarten sex classes. What happens when a child is exposed to this? Well, when such exposures are made, there is an undue intensification of and lingering in exhibitionism and voyeurism. Instead of passing smoothly and quickly through this, they cause the child to linger in these exhibitionistic, voyeuristic materials, and as a result, forward sexual growth may cease, and seeing and showing becomes the primary sexual aim from then on. And this is how you get to be a pervert. In such cases, the eye replaces the genital organ as a primary sexual sight in later life. Now, I won't go into the psychoanalytic reasons why some children may be spared, but not if they continue on with the sex education courses from K to 12. Indeed, over the years, the widespread interferences in the sexual development of 3 to 5 year old can be seen by anyone, by the ever-increasing exhibitionism and voyeurism that has become a part of our everyday culture. Pornographic books and magazines are available at practically every newsstand, and there are few, if any, movies that fail to show nudity and at least one intimate bedroom scene, including the G pictures. Hundreds of millions of dollars are spent each year in the United States by today's young people just for pornographically oriented videotapes and records alone. The kindergarten sex instructions given to the 3 to 5 year old children regarding mating causes still further problems. Psychoanalysis has shown that when a child is permitted to watch people mate, whether supervised by a sex teacher or not, the sex act is invariably regarded as a sadistic subjugation, that is, an abuse of the female. The cruelty feelings in children subjected to such demonstrations of classroom may be strengthened. A massive amount of sadism and masochism may dominate these children's later adult sex life. And indeed, there's a tremendous sadism in that that in the first 30 years of practice I never even heard of. I see routinely, or I have seen routinely in the latter 20 or so years. Kindergarten instructions regarding continual displays of the genitals cause further disruptions in normal. During the age of 3 to 5, there are indeed intervals the child has inclination to fondle his genitals. If through the teachings of sex educators or a child molester, a child is encouraged to linger in such genital sex play and learns to obtain satisfaction from the genital organ, the child is then obliged back satisfaction and again. Through the act of repetition, adolescent masturbation may continue right through childhood, adolescence, and into adulthood, constitute the future deviation of sexual development. Consider just one example. There are many, but just an example of what happened to a result of such adaptation. Let's consider a girl, for example, led to engage in repeated clitoral play by a child molester or by kindergarten sex instructions. This young lady may grow up, most likely, and become a nymphomaniac. But a nymphomaniac is a shambles. For her, the sex act is merely a compulsive, affectionate-less urge to repeat her early fixation in sex play. Any man who opens with her is considered a suitable partner. Appetite is like the alcoholics from she gets from it. There is no worldly chance that she will ever be capable of making a mature, monogamous, life-sustaining sexual adjustment, irrespective of whether she gets married, has children, or whatever. The nymphomaniac patients that I have seen in my practice, some of them have pretty nice children, pretty nice husbands, but it's a compulsive urge to repeat that early experience, and they just cannot stop themselves from going to the local bars, meeting men. Well, it gets pretty sickly when you have to treat these people, and you realize there's practically nothing you can do because these people have been molded, and this is the way they're going to be. So then, a brief review of the harm done by kindergarten sex teachings. Given during the first phase of human sexual development, what harm does kindergarten sex education do? I repeat, one, these instructions may cause an arrest in forward sexual growth and produce a lifelong fixation and exhibitionistic, voyeuristic sensual pleasures, which become, or rather, which make a mature sexual adjustment in later life virtually impossible. Two, demonstrations of mating given to the 3 to 5 year old strengthen aggressive cruelty feelings, which may lead to sadistic, masochistic dispositions when these children grow up. And three, and this is not all, but we'll end here, kindergarten sex teachings encourage an undue lingering in genital sex play, which may cause continuous masturbation throughout childhood, adolescence, and adulthood. Such masturbatory practices weaken character and preclude the development of a mature adult sexuality. But before concluding these brief comments on the first phase of human sexual development and of the harm done by kindergarten sex education, one important additional finding should be noted. Contrary to the, I may add the word, erroneous, fallacious teachings promulgated by sex educators that perversions such as homosexuality are due to glandular, genetic, or inherited conditions, over 100 years of psychoanalytic observations repeatedly substantiated, and that's how you learn what truth is, by repeatedly and critically substantiating an observation. And these observations have been repeatedly substantiated by real clinical investigations, not by someone taking a statistical evaluation or sending out a questionnaire. These investigations have unequivocally shown that adult perverts are primarily a product of premature sexual experiences or seductions in early childhood. There's no two ways about it. This is true whether the seduction is due to actual attacks by a child molester or whether the seduction is due to overexposures to sexual activities in the classrooms or in the pornographic media. Well, we got through the first phase. Now let's go to the second phase of human sexual development, meant between the ages of 6 to 12. And as before, let us consider the sex education courses given to these children 6 to 12 years old in the second phase of human sexual development. The second phase, as you probably know already, is referred to throughout the world as a latency period. It is a period in which nature causes direct sexual energies in the 6 to 12-year-old child to become dormant, quiescent. There is nothing hypothetical about the latency period. It has been shown to exist in all people throughout the world, in primitive people as well as civilized people. Though direct sexual energies become dormant or quiescent during latency, these energies do not disappear, but they are redirected by the 6 to 12-year-old child's mind and are used to serve other purposes. I could go into a psychoanalytic explanation of why, but that may be too burdensome, but let me come back to that then. But, for example, some redirected sexual energies is used for acquiring knowledge. This is why the 6 to 12-year-old child is the most educable, more than he'll ever be in the rest of his life. Prior to the establishment of today's public school teachings, teachers, your teachers, some of you people out there that, not my peers, because I guess I'm older than everybody, but in that general range, teachers used to believe and used to realize that involving the 6 to 12-year-old child in sexual matters made the child ineducable. And they made every possible effort to avoid arousing the child in sexual activities or sexual teaching. And as a matter of fact, repeated scholastic tests done year after year on today's sexually educated 12-year-old children indeed show that these students have accomplished far less scholastically than pre-sex education students. The educability of children is not all that is at stake when latency is disturbed by classroom sex interferences. For example, some redirected sexual energy is used by the child's mind for development of compassion. Compassion is essential for the control of cruelty impulses. Compassion is one of the elements that truly separates man from all other creatures. The important thing is that if compassion fails to develop during the years of 6 to 12, and there's a reason why sexual energy is diverted or what we call sublimated into compassion in these years, but if compassion fails to develop during the ages of 6 to 12 due to keeping direct sexual energy stirred up in the school sex classes, it is most unlikely for compassion to develop at any other time in life. Seemed like I read a novel the other day where it said this criminal who been killing millions and millions, I have a tendency to hyperbole here, but this criminal who's killing people, he was going to develop compassion now that he's 30 years old and stop doing that. Well, I don't think that would be possible. The book was not in touch with reality. And most of the times, the authors do capture human characteristics pretty well. But anyway, in addition to these things I already mentioned, normal latency makes invaluable contributions to personal and cultural achievements. Finally, and most important, latency is also responsible for strengthening inborn mental barriers that control base sexual and aggressive instinctual forces. These mental barriers consist of feelings of shame, consist of feelings of disgust, moral ideas, believe it or not, are inborn, they've been with us so long, aesthetics, pain, horror, etc. These barriers I mentioned are inborn and are essential for controlling raw sexual and aggressive urges. Though inborn, to be effective in later life, these mental barriers must be strengthened during the years of 6 to 12 by family, school, and religion. Instead of strengthening these controls, however, school sex courses use every educational and psychological technique known to break down these natural barriers. Removing mental controls over base sexuality is completely contrary to family life and civilized sexuality. Now, I have had patients who are sex educators, and I have spoken with them about some of these things, and I'm always impressed by the fact that some of these educators actually applaud the unrestrained, brazen attitudes of their sexually instructed 6 to 12-year-old students and proclaim that such personality traits are evidence of increased social acumen. However, the personality traits that the educators applaud are frequently the early characteristics of an uncaring psychopath. That is, an individual who has no concern for anyone but himself or others insofar as they can serve some purpose for him. The psychopathy in today's sexually educated 6 to 12-year-old children has reached alarming proportions. Preteen murders, pregnancies, prostitution, criminality, and venereal disease are no longer uncommon. This increase in crime, violence, and sex over the past 20 or so years is even more shocking when one considers that the 6 to 12-year-old child who has not been sexually disturbed is normally a most responsible individual and one least likely to be involved in sociopathic behavior. To sum up then, some adverse effects of sex education given to 6 to 12-year-old children are, one, sex teaching make the 6 to 12-year-old child less educable. Two, the courses can block the development of compassionate feelings. And three, the sex courses weaken mental barriers controlling base sexuality, thereby making the child vulnerable to perversions. And four, the teachings hamper social, cultural, and personal achievements. Very good. You stood through me through two phases, and now we're on the last phase, and I'll be through this somewhat technical aspect. Okay, we now come to the third and last phase of human sexual development, and to the sex courses given to adolescent students. The third phase begins in puberty, around the age of 13, and continues through adolescence into early adulthood. In this final phase of human sexual development, latency that we just came through, 6 to 12, comes to an end, and direct sexual feelings are once again reawakened. Direct sexual feelings are no longer dormant now, and they become reawakened. In the case of the 13-year-old boy, the reawakened energies are direct and are centered in the genitalia. The reawakened feelings of the 13-year-old girl follows a much, much, much different course. And I am emphasizing that with three muches because the sex educators don't seem to realize this. Because a girl's genital structures are biologically unready and remain anesthetic to sexual intercourse until much later in life, and because her feminine psychology is not completed until late adolescence, nature has provided the young female with a natural aversion to sexual intercourse. Though the teenage girl has a natural aversion to engaging in the sex act, paradoxically, her sexual feelings may be as intense as the boy's. Her desires, however, are not for genital intercourse, but instead, they involve sensual fantasies and dreams, kisses and caresses, the desire to love and be loved, tender words of love, sometimes thoughts of pregnancy and having a child. But again, her erotic feelings are not inseparably entwined with the sex act such as they are in the male. Now, one can learn from all sources. I studied under Kinsey at a time, and some of his statistics are quite good. He himself, in a statistical way, proved the psychological precepts that I just mentioned. Now, we all know that there are sexually 13-year-old girls, 14, 15-year-old girls that have sex. But we're talking about the natural, normal concern of these girls. They're not for genital sex. Of course, they've been led into it, but and there are problems that go along with it. But again, I don't want to belabor you at this short time or this interval for giving you those facts. Love fantasies in the adolescent girls are the natural and beneficial means for expressing their sexual wishes. Such fantasies are absolutely necessary for the development of a feminine personality, which many feminists now decry, but nevertheless there is a core of femininity. And such fantasies are necessary for the development of this core, this feminine core. And also it's necessary for the maturation of motherhood feelings. Today's sexually educated teenage female who fails to abide by natural feminine inhibition and is led to engage by sex teaching, to prematurely engage in sex, reacts with feelings of disappointment, coldness, and emptiness. Due to engaging in intercourse prematurely, her feminine psychology fails to develop. Her feminine feelings become dry and sterile, and a lifelong conflict develops between herself, her inner femininity, and her motherhood feelings. This dichotomy between the adolescent boy's readiness for sex and the girl's natural sexual inhibition serves a vital purpose. The girl's reluctance to the sex act serves to strengthen the affectionate and spiritual nature of sex. Adolescent female chastity is essential for the development of affectionate relationships and for the spiritualization of sex. Through sexual spiritualization, adolescents learn to regard the sex act and the sex partner with ultimate importance. When affectionate needs are not met during sexual intercourse, whether in adolescents or adults, and physical sex is all that remains, frustrations result, which frequently lead to serious mental depressions. For relief from these depressions, many of today's sexually active youth turn to perversions, alcohol, drugs, and not infrequently suicide. Adolescents admitted to hospitals for depression have tripled, and suicide has increased by 200% since the establishment of school sex education. An epidemic of adolescent suicides is now sweeping the United States. Teenage suicides now rank as the second leading cause of death in young people under 21. According to my biases, I think it's the number one cause. Because what is excluded by the statisticians who come up that suicide is only the second cause of death, they exclude drunken driving, the use of drugs, violence, and things of that nature, which is number one cause. But a lot of these things, such as drunken driving and the use of drugs, is a means of self-extermination. And so if you put all of these together, you might make a case for it being number one cause, but that's neither here nor there. It's close enough. In the March 21, 1985 edition of the Los Angeles Jewish Community Bulletin, psychiatrist Dr. Richard Bloom reports that the dramatic rise in teen suicides can be directly attributed to the sex life of today's young adolescent. Psychiatrist Bloom says, quote, having extremely active sex life, by the time they're 14, teenagers have lost that feeling of looking forward to a special someone. Most kids have been through every kind of sexual experience by the time they're 16, end of quote. Let's digress for a moment, if you will, and take a look at the standards and values that today's Planned Parenthood sponsored sex programs give junior and senior high school students. The values and standards taught go out of their way to tear down the values and morals of parents and the Judeo-Christian religions. The consciences instilled in the minds of children by parents are decimated by the school sex instructions. Under the leadership of sex teachers, inexperienced youths are taught to set up their own values that in fact consist of having no values at all. Students are led to believe that values simply depend on enjoying what you do and doing what you enjoy. Now, should these statements that I've made up until this point about the teachings given by sex educators seem too hard to believe, an examination of any ordinary sex education teacher's guide and resource manual should be made. As, for example, this Planned Parenthood teacher's manual used in Santa Cruz, California. I've examined a number of these from New England all the way to Santa Cruz, California, and I can tell you they're all about the same. There's about much difference between it when one watermelon and another watermelon, and maybe a better analogy, but there's very little difference. This is a typical manual. And the material in it is what is provided by Planned Parenthood for schools throughout the nation. Now, in this manual, the values and standards sections consist of three topics only. If you wish to read it, you can see it. The first of the three topics is human sexual responses, which is based on the reports of 300 or so paid and unpaid volunteers and prostitutes used by Masters and Johnson to engage in sex acts while monitored by viewers and electronic devices. Now, as a physician, it seems to me, what is the word, fatuous, ridiculous, inane, to hook up 300 or so paid and unpaid volunteers and prostitutes, put electrodes on their head, do an electrocephalogram, put an EKG electrode on their heart, and do an electrocardiogram, and when they have orgasms, see what kind of response you get. Well, they invariably find that the rates go up. But, I mean, what has this got to do with human sexuality? Mary Calderon claims it's the greatest investigation that mankind has ever had. Mary Calderon, as you may know, is one of the chief sex leaders. Now, the second topic discussed in sexuality and values in this manual, which is the same as all the others, is masturbation. The masturbation discussion consists of explaining and sanctioning all forms of masturbation that lead to orgastic emissions. If parents object to open masturbation, these manuals actually tell the students to masturbate more privately in order to avoid family arguments. That's the only reason. The third and final topic discussed in the sexuality and values section, a section that is supposed to somehow give people, young people, better values than established ones, is homosexuality. Homosexuality is taught as a normal variation, that is a normal lifestyle. The manuals advise sex teachers to bring homosexuals directly into the classroom in order to give students first-hand information about how homosexuals conduct themselves sexually. Students are taught that the homosexual's oral genital sex acts, his oral anal acts, his self-mutual masturbation, etc., etc., ad nauseum, are normal and beneficial. The only prerequisite for engaging in homosexual lesbian sex acts students are taught is that one enjoy them. Recently, since AIDS has become a critical homosexual and national problem, one additional prerequisite has been added to the class instructions. Students are now advised to use condoms when engaging in homosexual acts or when having sex with promiscuous sex partners. However, sodomy and other deviant sex acts are still taught as beneficial and as normal as heterosexual intercourse. The sexual values and standards taught in Planned Parenthood promoted school programs had nothing to do with sexual morality. The teachings are simply condemnations of indifferent sex acts with indifferent sex partners, glorification of perverts, approbation of masturbation, and detailed instructions in contraception and abortion. There is one main overriding theme in today's school's program, sex programs, and that theme is carnality. School sex teachings are essentially how-to courses that condone and teach fornication along with all forms of perverted sex. Some teachers, for example, one sex teacher at Long Beach, California State College up the road here, award extra credits to students who participate in perversions outside of the classroom and then come back to the classroom and port their perverted experiences to these other students. They get a good grade that way. Such horrendous teachings not only create perverts out of some students, but an over-tolerance for perverts is instilled in the minds of all students. This undue over-tolerance for perversions promoted as understanding, openness, frankness, etc., liberty, freedom, destroys the natural mental defense mechanism. To shun the pervert is a means of avoiding contamination. As a result, students are left defenseless. Teaching youth an over-tolerance for perverts and an acceptance of the belief that orgasm achieved by any means is beneficial can lead young people into becoming affectionateless, polymorphous, mechanical robots capable of engaging in any kind of sex act with indifference and without guilt. These, as you know, are the characteristics of prostitutes and pimps. Along with carnal teachings, the sex courses provide students with complete instructions on abortions and contraception. The callous persuasiveness used to teach students about abortion has so desensitized students to abortion that should a sexually educated girl become pregnant, she submits to having these psychologically mutilating operations with about as much concern as having a manicure. Indeed, to meet the demands of today's unwed preteen and teen pregnancies, abortion clinics have become as commonplace as beauty parlors. It seems ludicrous, but after desensitizing the minds of students year after year to carnality, sex educators had the temerity to claim that their courses can prevent teen and preteen pregnancies if only the public would be more supportive of school sex programs and school-based health clinics. The Alan Guttmacher Institute, which is a major activistic arm of Planned Parenthood, goes even further. The Alan Guttmacher Institute places the blame for today's preteen and preteen pregnancies on American manufacturers for not developing better contraceptives for sexually educated students. The Guttmacher Institute and Planned Parenthood sex educators do not begin to place the blame on themselves for the sexual disasters in young people today, but they point their fingers accusingly at parents in the United States Congress for not providing more and more funds for public school sex programs. Despite arguments to the contrary given by sex educators, the truth is that since the establishment of sex education and more recently school-based health clinics, there has been an ever-increasing worsening of pregnancies, promiscuity, and venereal diseases in sex-educated students. Millions of teenagers become pregnant each year. In 1979, for example, it was first determined that 5 million adolescent girls between the ages of 15 and 19 engaged in sexual intercourse. 1 year later, it takes a year to have a full-term pregnancy. In 1980, 1,100,000 pregnancies occurred in these 5 million sexually active 15 to 19-year-old girls. 460,000 of these pregnancies ended in abortion. Bear in mind that this statistical information does not begin to include the number of pregnancies and abortions in the 10 to 14-year-old sexually educated. Somebody told me they had a child that had a baby at 10 years of age. I think it was written up in one of these tabloids. Who ever heard of such a thing? But these 10-year-old sexually educated girls, which who have no desire for sexual intercourse, but who are led into it by peer pressure and school teachings, they get babies nowadays. At any rate, such statistics were unprecedented prior to today's sex education. Dr. C.A. Dones, in his article appearing in the Medical Economics magazine, had it right when he said that one would require 20/20 ostrich vision to dismiss such statistics as coincidence. Nowhere do the sex educators make the slightest suggestion that their devastating sex programs rank among the greatest tragedies that our nation has ever endured, and that their sex courses should be stopped. Nowhere do they give the slightest explanation why school teachers have peremptorily assumed the right to inculcate carnality in the minds of young people, while at the same time they denounce any responsibility for upholding life-sustaining sexual morality. At no time do the sex teachers remotely suggest that the cure for today's teen pregnancies, prostitution, venereal diseases, criminality, and suicides necessitates that the educational system upholds the family and respects basic Judeo-Christian morality, a morality that supports the struggle for existence, a morality that sustains civilized life, and a morality that is in line with the great religions of the Far East. The sex educators have either a mental block, that is a strong repression, or for some reason cannot see that their sex teachings are largely responsible for the psychological as well as the physical sexual sickness that is rife among many of today's youth. The national sexual calamity among many of our youths remain unabated. The question is, have the teachings of the sex educators and the influence of the pornographic entertainment media so thoroughly persuaded the public to accept preteen and teen sex, free love and perversions, that they have already caused a decline in our nation that has reached the point of no return? Assuming that this point has not been reached, what can be done? First, I believe the sexually gangrenous material filling the minds of young people as a result of today's sex education and the pornographic entertainment media must stop forming. Alternative preventing further spread of contamination is urgently needed. Planned Parenthood-type sex educators must be led to know that we have had enough. Local, state, and national school officials must be led to know that we expect them to translate our outrage into educational courses that serve the needs of civilized people, not the needs of unrestrained barbarians. There can be no compromise. Free love and perversions cannot exist side by side with mature love and family life. Each destroys the other. In conclusion, two matters should be stressed. The first is that for the continued existence of life-sustaining sex, which is completely dependent upon affectionate, monogamous man-woman love relationships, it is as necessary to eradicate today's psychological venereal diseases as it is to eradicate today's physical venereal diseases such as AIDS. And the second matter that I'd like to conclude with is that for the survival of our civilization based on families composed of individuals living by consciences instead of barbarians living by instinct only, life-sustaining sexual morality, which is in accord with human sexual needs, must be maintained not only in our homes, but also in the schools to which we entrust our children.
Thank you, Dr. Anshaw. It's time now for questions. We have a microphone over there. Simply line up one by one and ask your question. I'm sure that Dr. Anshaw will be very pleased to respond. first question. Dr. Anchel, we hear so much from educators. Information is the answer. Sexual delinquency is the result of a lack of scientific information concerning sexuality. A lot of parents have bought that cliche, that slogan. But I'm interested in what you would have to say concerning the necessity of information to young people so that they can cope with sexual desire and sexual temptation.
Be a cliche to say, because I'm sure you all know this, that the studies done, personally I prefer psychoanalytic studies because they deal with the whole patient and discuss the problem that you're trying to determine in the patient. But our society seems to have gotten away from that and go more readily to statistical methods, questionnaire methods, and this type of thing. But the information from the social scientists, and I may say from psychoanalysis, is that the more you educate these kids about this matter, these matters, first of all, you interfere with every stage of development. But let's assume that you did. Let's just look at it as a drug problem. The more you educate these children in drugs, the more you educate them in sex, we find, according to what the social scientists tell us, that the more rampant the problems become. So that, take for instance the AIDS problem. In England, they spent much, much more on an AIDS education program than they did here recently. And they found that the AIDS problem increased. They found that the states and the cities, such as Los Angeles and other parts of California, that spend the most money on sex education is where they have the greatest illegitimacy, illegitimate pregnancies, prostitution, etc., etc. For instance, Michigan, where back in 1981, I believe, they had a law that required that these children could only get contraceptives and have abortions with the parents being informed, they found that the pregnancy rates in the young people dropped very significantly. I think in 1986 someone removed that law and the pregnancy rates and the abortion rates and prostitutions increased precipitously. These are the same experiences found out and throughout now. And now with the school-based health clinics, we're nothing more than contraceptive clinics, an abortion clinic, they find that where these clinics are set up, the pregnancies go up. Now, of course, you can make statistics prove anything. For instance, in the Baltimore study where they had the school-based sex clinic, the people who ran that came out with a very fallacious and misleading information that the pregnancy rate went down. But it went down simply because they didn't include the number of abortions that was included. They felt that any girl that had an abortion should not be considered pregnant. But when they considered the abortions and the pregnancy, then it went up quite a bit. And the same thing happened in the Chicago study and the LaSalle study, and there was another one. But the problem here is this. Sex education is not education. It's a destruction of human sexual processes. The way one gets sex educated, and I'm going to talk about the ideal, because the ideal is what we all strive for, although we realize that the ideal sometimes is not reachable. But let's at least aim for it and then come in that direction, even though some of these cases may not be ideal. But the way a child learns about human sexuality is from the parents. Now, hopefully, the parents aren't drunkards, the parents aren't divorced, the parents aren't this, the parents aren't that. Parents are loving, monogamous people who love each other and love their children. That's the ideal, and that's what we'll use our example. So the parents teach the children what it is to love someone, such as the member of the opposite sex. They show the affection not only with themselves but with their children. They teach the children modesty. If a child walks into the room while the parents are engaged in some intimate sex act, you don't learn not to do that, and you don't protect the child by hitting him over the head with a hammer, which I think would be less injurious than the sex education classes. But you simply let him know by your demeanor that Bill or Tom have closed the door, thank you, and will you please knock before coming in? You teach them modesty. And shame. Shame is normal. It protects people against perversions. If you don't have any shame, you become an... When I say you, I'm speaking general. Become exhibitionistic and voyeuristic inclined. So you have to learn this from your home. Granted that not every home has the ideal background, and therefore some children do grow up with problems here and there. But one thing we know for sure, however bad the mother and father is, the sex education is abomination compared to it. What's that?
Yes, I want to have a comment rather than a question, but I want to put forth to you the need to support Secretary Bennett in all his efforts as the Secretary of Education, with the National Education Association fighting him at every point. And he has in many instances promoted not only better education subjects and tightening of curriculum and all, but the saying of no and the reasons for not doing what we're doing in sex education in the schools. There's one very good paper he has done, and it's reprinted with Father Blum's group, the Catholic League, in which he states very clearly the positions that you would take. And it just seems to me that at this time, it would be the greatest thing we could do to give him support in what he is trying to do, among other things, to clear up the sex education in the schools.
I would say amend to that, and I wholeheartedly agree with it. It does seem to me rather a pity that children have to have signs painted and have to be advised to say no. This means that they have already been brainwashed into believing that if you want to be most chic and the leader of the group, you say yes, but you say no. I mean, why do you have to tell a child to say no? Without sexual interferences in our day, and I'm sure you're younger than I in your day, no one had to tell you when you were 13 to say no. First of all, you already felt protected against saying no because you had no desire to have intercourse. You may have wanted to be in love with some young man or something like that, and you may have wanted him to love you, but it wasn't for the desire for sexual intercourse. The problem is that the male does have such a desire, but normally he doesn't express it actively either, because by not doing so, he develops ideal for girls. Some girls become important for him, more so than others, by the repression or the forestalling of direct sexual action. So it seems to me a pity that our nation, or any nation, has reached the point where we have to go around telling some girls that if they want to say no, it's okay. And the implication is the other girls say, yes, that's okay too, and it isn't okay. But I do agree with you, Secretary Bennett has done a great deal. Unfortunately, he's up against Planned Parenthood organizations, which are funded to millions and millions of dollars. And his organization, because I was once there in Washington to help distribute some of this money, and the problem is the money has to be distributed. Regardless of what the thing is, you have to find the least. And sometimes there is no lease, but you have to distribute anyway. I'm afraid William Bennett is going to be voiced down. These people won't let him come forward. I heard him on TV the other day, and they really racked him up for his statements at Stanford. and asked him actually if he wanted to apologize for it, and he said, I have nothing to apologize for, but it's amazing what the press and the people who are prejudiced towards these programs will do.
But he's showing great strength, and that my point was that if we all got behind him in our various ways in which we can do something, that it might keep him from being ground under, as you are predicting. I don't think he will be.
It's the only hope he has, you're right. And the problem is when you say we all don't get behind him. I know I sound like a pessimist, but I'm not. I'm an optimist when the truth leads in that direction. But, you know, the other night my wife, we live near here, we live in Mission Viejo, and she went shopping up here at the center. And coming home, it took her 2 hours to get from Irving Center Boulevard, which is only a few miles from where we live, 2 hours to get from there to our house. And the reason was there was a rock concert at the local amphitheater called the Grateful Dead. And the Grateful Dead apparently is so popular that they had cars lined all the way back up to this area, front and back. And here we have a program that is of absolutely vital importance, and I don't think we're going to cause any traffic jam. But I do agree that people such as yourself, if it's just more than words, if you do everything humanly possible, it's the only chance. And again, it's a cliche to say that when a civilization reaches height, it frequently declines. And the declines for the reasons that we've been talking about, a lack of morality. And, you know, this is characteristic of primitive people, too. They lack morality in matters such as sexuality and so forth. And so what you say is true, and I hope to God that you and every person here exerts themselves tediously, arduously, assiduously, what other word is there, to make yourselves heard, because it is our hope.
Yes. I had two statements I wanted to make to Dr. Nanchel. One is, I'm a physician in the area, and I see the same thing that you see, the 13-year-olds with BD and all the drug and the alcohol problems. I think that this is a tremendously bad situation that we're in right now, and we need to be as strong as we can and put our energies into this as well as we can, very rationally and with good, you know, caring attitude and so forth. I think I agree with a lot of what you said today, but I think that some of your statements were overstatements or statements without any basis of research, any studies to back them up, like showing 5-year-olds you know, pictures of genitals going to lead to perverts. I think that it weakens our side by making comments that we can't really back up strongly. If we make strong comments about the few issues that exist, then we'll be heard better. But it's easy for Planned Parenthood or someone else to say that we're just full of it, that just dismiss us because we're making these outrageous statements. If we can't back up everything that we say, I think we have to be much more careful about that. Planned Parenthood, they make their mistakes, and the people that we're opposed to make their mistakes, and we can point to them. We don't want to allow them the opportunity to point back to us, and I would just caution you on that. The other thing that I would comment on is I think that...
Why don't we take one statement at a time or one point at a time, if you will, because when you get my age, if you can handle one point, you can do all right. The problem that is presented, and it's a good problem, that I shouldn't say things that in this gentleman's experience isn't true. And his argument is that teaching kids about drugs and so forth helps matters rather than worsens it. Well, sir, that may be your experience.
No, I'm not saying it helps. I'm saying that
moment,
to show somebody genitals leads them to be perverted.
I'm not arguing with your expertise, but my expertise is that teaching such things to children, how drugs are used, what their compounds are, et cetera, leads to further drug use. If
right.
your expertise differs, you have a right to it.
No, I agree with that, but what I'm saying is that you're so simplifying the situation that it obscures the fact of the matter that these kids that are perverts, they've probably grown up with alcoholic parents, parents that use drugs, and there's a whole slew of other things behind it. It just simplifies the issue to say that showing a kid a picture of genitals is going to lead to perversion. It's a very complex issue as to why that kid became a pervert, And it's an error, I think, that the studies won't bear out that you show a child a picture and he's going to be a pervert.
Well, I must say, I didn't quite understand your question. I'm sorry, I don't think the microphones are working too well. But regardless, you may have some different experiences than I, and you certainly, you know, whatever helps you make a solution for yourself, fine. If what I've said can be of value, fine. If you find some other expert that can give you some other information that's more beneficial to you, you should use that.
Okay. I would just try and back up as much as you can with factual information or with data.
I'm not going to be able to give you a bibliography or documentation that dates back from 1944. Okay. You just have to accept it or otherwise.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
One more comment was that I think that the children in our society receive a sex education through the media and so forth, and we have to be very careful with what we do to counteract that. And I think that possibly you're not pushing for sex education in the schools, and I understand there's many, many problems with that. I wonder if maybe we shouldn't be educating the parents with sex education, because the parents really need to teach the children. They're obviously not doing that. Maybe we need sex education for parents or some other option.
There
I don't know what...
There is no creature on this world, if you want to go down to the lowly AIDS virus, to the paramecium, to the baboons, that need to go to school to learn how to mate, number one. And the other thing is, you're right. The children are subjected to a lot of pornographic, sexually disturbing material in the media and other places. We're literally immersed in it in our society today. But the problem, sir, is that sex education is the first point of attack. And the reason is that they may see something in a movie, and they may see something in a radio, but as you know, teachers in the school are a home away from home. They are parent surrogates. And what the school teaches becomes much more important to a child because he assumes this is the truth. But what he sees on a poster, a billboard, or a magazine at a newsstand, he recognizes as being a fantasy. And so the school is the first place that we have to make our mark. Because as long as we let the schools teach this stuff, pornographers can say, well, they learned it in school. And let me tell you, I don't know how much sex education courses you studied or happened to look into. I happen to have testified on 4 cases from Connecticut to Honolulu. And so I think I know a little bit about what's going on. And I can tell you what is shown in pornography is no bit better or worse than what they show in sex education. I've testified in X-rated movie cases and things like that. And I can tell you the thing that lingers in my mind is the most shameful, the most vulgar, the most despicable thing I've ever seen in my life regarding human sexuality was a film shown to sex classes in Alabama showing a young girl, 16, and a boy, 17, mating on a lawn. Somehow or other, it just was absolutely nauseating. And so what they're saying being shown in the pornographic media is no different than what they're being taught in these sex classes.
I think you and I would probably agree on that point, that we shouldn't be showing that kind of stuff in the school. We shouldn't even necessarily have any sex education.
I always hear a comment that, but that doesn't happen in our classes. Well, let me tell you that California was one of the first classes, the first states to ever have sex education, and I was asked to testify before the school board in Anaheim. And I saw their program, and I admit, when they started it off, it looked like it was very innocuous, and because of the pressure of the citizens, they didn't introduce it after that school board meeting in which I was one of the participants. 6 months later, they had it in. And it goes from what looks like an innocuous thing within a matter of months or at most a year to nothing more than pornography. Now, again, let me say, if you had different experiences, fine. I'm delighted that there are some classes that aren't that way.
Well, we're just not communicating too well, but I agree with you that we shouldn't be teaching sex education probably in the schools, but I'm just trying to figure out how we counteract society's education of children otherwise, because I think the children do get educated sexually in a very bad way through the media, and whether you do that through the parents or
not. The only way you can counteract it is by developing a social conscience. The society cannot tolerate it, and that's what it's all about. And as long as it does tolerate it, you're not going to be able to do anything about it. The parents are the representatives of society, and the conscience that is instilled in the child's mind is given to him by his parents. Now, if the society, such as we have today, condones all these things and considers it a natural part of our culture, then young parents will consider it to be normal, and they will teach their children that these things are normal, and that's what's happening. But there must be a recalling of social conscience based on morality.
Yeah. Dr. Anshel, I thought your talk was magnificent. I have four children. I'm a Canadian, and we have the same problem in Canada as you have here. And my first three children, I managed to keep out of the sex education. It was beneath them, and they could see that. They just wouldn't go to those kind of programs. They walked out. They never were in them. However, I have a son who is now in the new English curriculum which they've brought in. And I'm very concerned because in this English curriculum, everything is taught from the angle of sex. Hamlet, for instance, he spent 6 weeks proving that Hamlet had the problem of being incest with whatever there was. Macbeth, Romeo and Juliet. And how do you cope with this as a parent? Fortunately, he's in grade 12, but I have other friends who have this problem. Every piece of poetry has some abnormal sex in it. And my son does come home and tell me, but what about the other 30 from the class who don't?
The question is, how do you cope with it? Well, I must tell you, since 1947, although I'm I recently retired, a full-time physician, I've done everything I could to cope with it. I've seen people like yourselves who attend meetings such as this do everything they can to cope with it. And we have been plowed under, and it just gets worse. I was up to Atascadero, where they were going to put in a little program that wasn't going to hurt anybody. It just showed a little nudity, and they had little cards sponsored by Planned Parenthood. And I wasn't able to speak because up in the first row they had sex educators, and every time I'd open my mouth, I'd get a hurrah. And the school board was prejudiced as a doe. Every time I said something, I got interrupted. I finally closed the book and said, let it go. I mean, you just can't. But I got a letter from one of the people up at Atascadero the other day. It's in that thing there, if you wanted to see it. It says, we were told we were going to have these little pictures, and my son, who refused to watch the XXXX rated movie that was being shown. This was only 4 months later since I'd given the talk. No talk about giving movies. He walked out of the class because it has upset his sensibilities, as it should. The teacher told him he was going to get an F if he did.
Well, that happened.
And the other problem is these sex educators had you coming and going because some of schools start out by saying, well, if you don't want your child in your class because you're old-fashioned and prudish, you know, immediately you're dead as soon as they use those terms, then you can keep him out of the class if you write us a letter. So you write a letter, and what they do, they keep the kids in the hall room or some study class while their peers are taking this material. Now, one of the main instinctual drives of a young person is to be like his peers. So he feels terrible. And then to add insult to the injury or salt on the wound, they make him take or her take the final examination anyway.
Exactly.
So, you know, Planned Parenthood has this figured out. I've often wondered, I can go into a small town like Atascadero, where they're very, very nice people. I mean, they're not it's not a gang warfare in the city. And The Planned Parenthood gets into the school board and they drop a seed, and there's no way to stop it. It'll just grow. And in 4 months, again, that city went, as most of them have, from we're going to show a few pictures of nudity to the little kids, and it's now up to where a kid has to walk out of high school because of an XXX rated movie, and he's failed in the course because of it. So it's a tough problem. But Planned Parenthood has so much money that they are not even bothering about us anymore. We are a fait accompli. We have been conquered just like Germans conquered France during World War II. They were just in there. And now what the Planned Parenthood organization is doing, they're going into South America. And their main base of operation is Trinidad. From there, they're heading into Venezuela and so forth. But they've got all this money to spend, and they're going to do it. But I don't know the answer. I wish I did. The only answer I have, the only hope I have, is that this room is an oasis from which others can come from now on, and you people do something. And I don't know what to tell you to do. You can complain to the school board all you want. They don't seem to pay much of attention, but somehow there must be an answer.
Just a comment. I don't know the things, I'm not against what you're saying. It just seems to me that when our Blessed Mother has appeared at Fatima and at Medjugorje, she has said prayer and penance. And I don't think we're mentioning God hardly at all in this. And it seems to me that we should be saying we need prayer, we need God, we need penance if we're going to change this whole thing. And my comment.
I accept that, and I was speaking as a physician, and I know there are a lot of theologians, and I leave that to you folks because you're much better at it than I am. But prayer is certainly something that we should all use in this matter.
I'm Dr. Herbert Ratner.
Oh, yes.
A former publisher of Child and Family, and we've published Dr. Anshul before, and we plan to continue to publish him again. I just want to point out two things because we're a small organization. We don't do much promotion, but here's a place to put a promotion that is. In the coming issue of Child and Family, which will be out maybe in about 6 weeks, we are reprinting six criticisms of modern sex education, five of them by non-Catholics. One by Tom Zoss, the maverick psychiatrist, who's anti-Catholic. He just sails into sex education tremendously. Another by the executive director of the high school principals, and so forth. So I'd urge you to consider starting a subscription with Child and Family. I also brought with me, in a last minute rush, a thing we put out on the contribution to the dialogue on sex education. It only sells for 50 cents, 32 pages. It's worth its weight in paper. But what's in it is very interesting because the Russians, the communists, in the 40s, 30s, did what we're doing now, developed a sex education course on the basis of anatomy and physiology, found out it was ruining their country, and they turned sex back into the family. And the report on their program is so interesting that on occasions when I've talked to priests and to sometimes bishops, I read their statement, and I said, who do you think wrote it? Fulton Sheen, Knights of Columbus, Cana Movement, so forth. And I say it comes from the Soviet Bureau, you know? So you'll find this very interesting and in addition to many illuminating articles. I know in my 50 years experience, I'm convinced we made out much better with the stork than we are doing with modern education. And at least we retain the mystery of what sex was all about. That's something you do on the front lawn in the back of a car. And so I bought some Child and Family materials. I'll have them up front, and you'll help me if you take some of them so I don't have to carry them back.
Dr. Anshul, I'm from Regina, Saskatchewan. So, Regina, Saskatchewan. Okay? And is it Regina, Saskatchewan, Father Lalonde's area?
Yes,
and I just have to tell the people here so they understand the importance of getting the information out. When Father Lalonde decided to print Dr. Anshul's article, he looked for the very best, something that could not be struck down for its content, so it was very carefully thought out. We were looking at trying to stop the homosexual juggernaut. We knew it was moving through, so that was a calculated thought in advance. And so when it was printed, it was the best thing that ever happened, and Father Lalonde certainly knew he was stepping into the traffic. But by doing that, he alerted, and a great resistance was able to be developed consequently. And we have stopped the demand for gay rights. Saskatchewan was the first province that really fought for it. But we took Dr. Anshul's article. We went to the Ottawa and had an audience with the Saskatchewan caucus. And we also went to the Papal Nuncio. We really pulled up the floorboards. And Dr. Anshul's material has been used extensively. I don't even think he realizes how well known he is. We've been pestering the open lines to bring him in. So this is somebody that's been very valuable, made a powerful contribution. We've not only stopped homosexuality because of Dr. Enchel's article, we've actually, which is true, and that is a tremendous, we have three provinces in the Yukon that are now have brought in gay rights to allow homosexuals to adopt children. And so this shows you what speaking out does. It's just powerful. It's just powerful. Thank you, Dr. Enchel.
I'm from the Riverside, California area and work with Right to Life. And these last 4 years, my last child, I let attend the public high school near my home rather than the Catholic high school were my last two attended. And it wasn't until I heard through the group that I work with Right to Life, how bad Planned Parenthood is, and my daughter had actually attended a two-day orientation that I was not informed of. I think the best way to fight a lot of these things, whether it's movies, whether it's the schools, is to hit them in the pocketbook. Even if just a couple of parents in every city announce that they are going to boycott the school and take their child out, you get other groups that are interested in doing it. It doesn't take many. At least you get some press coverage. The same thing with movies. You've got to hit these people in the pocketbook. My husband and I go to the movies every week. We have for 12 years. This is our entertainment. We have now seen in the last 2 to 3 years, and unless people go to the movies constantly, I don't think they realize how bad it's gotten. There is frontal nudity in PG-13 movies now. I'd like to see us get back to the old-fashioned Legion of Decency that used to be posted on the back of the church, and as you walked out on Sunday, you weren't allowed to go to the show unless you looked up what the rating was.
I think we've come to the end of our session. Evidently, Dr. Enchel will be back at the same place at 7:30 this evening for a panel discussion with some of the other speakers on sex education, which should be particularly interesting. Thank you all. Thank you.